I'll take hands. Okay, I see the hands of Honorable Mulder. Honorable Spring. Honorable Cuthbert. Okay, I think we will start off, Honorable Mulder.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I hope you can hear me. I see a message here that the host has disabled my video, so I'm not able to switch it on, if that's okay with you.
It's fine. We can hear you, though.
Thank you. Chair, now I won't be long. Let me start by thanking the Minister and HOD for a comprehensive document. I think it really shows that the department has got a latest scope of wide spectrum of aspects that it's working on and is doing valuable work. So much appreciation for the high quality and standard of it as well. I'm sure that the Honourable Minister was forced to have a cup of tea after that long period and all the slides that he had to go through. But just on a serious note, this is now a report of something that happened in history and a performance report, which I understand. What I'm trying to say is that we are living in an ever-changing world and environment, and especially in South Africa at the moment, so many things that's influencing us and that will most surely influence the next report to be presented to this committee. Honourable Chair, to the Honourable Minister and HOD, I'm very concerned on behalf of the Freedom Front Plus about the situation that we're sitting with Eskom. It's future music now that I'm talking about, because all of this work could actually be undone if we're not going to be able to save Eskom and have more constant electricity in South Africa. I only realized over the week that if you add all the hours of load shedding that we experienced in the year 2022 up till the end of October, if you add it all together, we had 100 days of darkness. We experienced 100 days of darkness in 2022. And this had a real negative impact on the economy. It's 2,400 hours. On average, it was stage 3, and it costed the economy 68.4 billion rand. If we take that into account, and the situation of Tongaat Hulett, who's gone into business rescue, I think we must realize that we live in extraordinary times and extraordinary measures will be necessary. And then just the last thing, and the Honorable Minister and members should please bear with me. The Honorable Minister of Finance mentioned in his address last week, he referred to empowerment, which is a main topic and exercise of this department. Talking about BBBE specifically, he said that to save Eskom, empowerment must go. Ntetu Nyati, one of the new board members of Eskom, said the same. Empowerment rules that hamper Eskom's performance will have to go, and there's no other choice if we really want to save Eskom. Now, why I'm mentioning this is I'm delighted to see how many people has been empowered by projects by this department. What I'm concerned about is the large number of people and institutions who's not been empowered. So my question would be, isn't it time that this department also consider, in line with what the Minister of Finance said, that in future, merit should play a larger role than empowerment. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Mulder. Honourable Spring.
Thank you, Chair. Like my colleague before me, Honorable Mulder, I also welcome the comprehensive presentation. And we admire the strength of the Minister's vocal cords, having spoken for about 2 hours. Impressive, Minister. But let me maybe start off by saying that the ACDP supports the focus on jobs. I believe that it is key. It's important. But the challenge is that while jobs covered may look impressive, Minister, in terms of the presentation, what is important is more than just the jobs covered. It is the actual amount of jobs created. And that also in comparison to our currently high unemployment rate. So maybe what we should be doing, and I want to ask the Minister whether he would consider this, is to look at some of our KPIs or targets as compared to, and I, you know, I'm speaking just also off the cuff, as compared to our high unemployment rate, perhaps our achievement within the department ought to be measured against reducing that particular high unemployment rate. So if we have an unemployment rate of 37%, and when one looks at the number of jobs created through the department, we can say we've reduced unemployment by this particular percentage. also, you know, express concern as well with regards to the declining growth projections within the developing countries, particularly those that we export to, coupled with the low growth in China. And I think that some of our exports in particular, and China is also one of our large trading partners. So Minister will be interested to see what some of the systems will be put in place to mitigate the effects of the forthcoming or projected growth projections, particularly within the developing economies. There are those who are actually predicting that 2023 we could see another financial crash as we saw in the previous years. We also welcome the attempt to remove red tape, concerned also about the inflationary pressure on food. I think my wife constantly complains about how almost every month when you go into the supermarket, there are increased prices. And so the inflationary pressure on food in particular, I think needs to be a cause for concern and something that we also need to keep our eye on. Then, Minister, just with regards to the scrap metal and cable theft that you mentioned as well, I wanted to know whether there was any, and there has been any research done in a move away from copper as a form of transmission of electricity and energy to other cheaper metals or other safer metals in terms of theft, like aluminium or so, for example. So whether there's been any research into that area. And then, Chair, with regards to the first and second quarter reports, slide 10, in terms of the presentation that was given to us, speaks of a number of reports on red tape reductions within ITAC as a key priority area for unlocking economic growth. And I think that this was a priority area, you know, in terms of red tape reduction, priority area mentioned by the President himself in his SONA addresses. And I think we've actually seen here targets not achieved in this particular area on red tape reduction in ITAC. And there were only two reports actually that were required as a target, and still we have a failure to reach those particular targets. And then just a concern with regards to whether we are giving the and allocating or projecting and giving the correct amount of targets. If one looks, for example, at slide 20, 24 billion rand annual target with respect to the rand value of projected investments from private sector to be leveraged. But the quarterly target, this is in the first quarter report, But the quarterly target was only 1 billion. Now you've got a target of 24 billion. You know, you divide that by four. It ought to be at least six billion target per quarter. Granted, I think in the second quarter the target there was 8.7. So we've seen an increase. And I just don't know why the first quarter was such a low target. You know, where you project an annual. An annual target of 24 billion, but within the first quarter you only projected 1 billion. Slide 26, again a similar response here or concern here. Invest SA 120 billion annual target for rand value of investment project pledges, but the quarterly target there of just 10 billion. So again, you divide 120 by the four quarters or by four. And you should be getting at least, you know, a 30 billion per quarter target. So perhaps how are we actually breaking up? And I know that perhaps you say no, but you know, we could look at instead of a 10 billion target, we could, you know, reach 40 billion or projected to reach 40, 50 billion in the forthcoming quarters. But just the planning in that seems to be a little bit out if one uses a pure mathematical model. So, and then again on that slide 26 with Invest SA, you know, only 1.1 billion was achieved. So, if one also looks at just on that same slide, I think it is slide 26. There's the unblocking and fast tracking of investor issues. And there you had a target of an annual target of 40. That's for unblocking and fast tracking. And a quarterly target of 10, which is in keeping with the mathematical model, but then you've got 447 achieved. So the question here is, have we underrated our targeting? You know, we're putting in low targets so that we can kind of overachieve. So just some questions around our target set in that regard. Thank you, Chair. I think those would be my questions and comments for now.
Thank you very much, Honourable Singh. Honourable Cuthbert?
Thanks very much, Chair. Sharing the sentiments of the colleagues that spoke before me, I think the Honourable Minister was out to beat Prince Buthelezi's record speech. It was quite a mouthful, and I'm surprised he didn't even stop to take a sip of water. So good on him for that. Just a couple of general questions, Chairperson. The first one being, what's the broader impact of localization and the master plans for designated industries is? I see that we've got a industry-based figure in the slides. However, I'd just like to know what the broader impact if one were to calculate all of these interventions together. And it could be a monetary number or also a percentage of contribution to GDP, because I think that would be indicative of whether or not the policy itself has been successful thus far. Also to find out whether or not the minister and his department have investigated the impact of localization on inflationary pressures that we are currently experiencing, and whether or not there has particularly been a cause for concern for him and the department. The second question that I'd like to ask, Chair, is regarding the appointment process of a DG. I had previously raised this issue, and it's my understanding that the acting DG has actually been appointed as the Accountant General. So I just want to understand what is happening there and when we can expect a final appointment of a permanent DG. As you know, there are a number of entities in this department that sit with acting executive structures, and I think it's important to finalise all of those human resource issues. The second thing is particularly with reference to ITAC, what is happening in terms of sourcing a new commissioner there? It's my understanding that not only now has the commissioner left, but the deputy commissioner, and my understanding is that there is, imminent change within the organisation itself, which is going to obviously impact on, the ability to lead the organization and to obviously stick to its program of direction. So what kind of plans does the minister and his department have in place for ITAC? The third question that I'd like to ask, Chair, is when a decision will be forthcoming on the scrap metal policy. The submissions closed on the 26th of August, if I'm correct in saying, and there has been some time to apply their minds from a cabinet point of view as well as from a ministry point of view. And we'd just like to understand when this decision will be forthcoming, because the longer that it holds out, obviously creates more uncertainty. It obviously makes it difficult for various industry players to invest in certain items because they're not aware of what it is that's going to take place moving forward. And I think it's always important, whether or not it's bad or good policy, is to obviously ensure that there's certainty and that people understand that government will act in a consistent way, whether bad or good. The last question that I have, Chair, is just to ask the Minister what his personal view is of AGOA. Does he want to lobby for that particular agreement to be extended, noting what the challenges within the Congress may be itself? Does he want a partial trade agreement, if not going for an extension, or is he looking at a full trade deal between the US and ourselves, with obviously developmental concessions and the like? If you could just make clear what his position is, particularly in light of the fact that we are going to be hosting the forum later this year, and considering that it is expiring in 2025, if I'm correct in saying, we need to obviously have a clear position on how we are going to pursue this, considering the large-scale nature of our trading relationship with the US. So if the Minister would not mind answering those questions, I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Cuthbert. Honourable Burns Namashi.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. Greetings to the Minister. Indeed, Honourable Chair, mine is really to follow suit, from what my colleagues have expressed in commending the presentation made by the Minister. It was quite comprehensive. Covered a number of areas that are key in terms of the transformation of the sector. And I think, Chair, one can actually witness a move that begins to put into context industrialization, trade, transformation, in the context, of South Africa, not only inwardly focusing on domestic production and consumption, but also creates networks in terms of export markets. It's something that we must really appreciate, Honorable Minister, because it's always important to leverage on those opportunities. And the other thing that I also want to really impress upon is around the appointments that the Minister has moved so swiftly in terms of various entities that are reporting to or that are under the custodianship of DTIC. In situations where there are uncertainties, whether in terms of political leadership or policy certainty, obviously that would not augur well for investment opportunities. So that there seems to be stability at the leadership of these institutions and clear policy compendium in terms of the approach and the character with which we advance the transformation agenda. It gives confidence to anyone who seeks to invest in South Africa. In fact, it positions South Africa as the most investor-friendly country. And perhaps the minister can also talk to the impact of our of the foreign policy as articulated by the South African government, to the extent that it will have an impact in terms of trade relations. For instance, the attitude of South Africa as it would relate to the war in Ukraine and Russia, that South Africa has been consistent in its stance that multilateral institutions must be given space to deal with the challenges that are there and encourage dialogue and negotiation amongst the parties rather than taking sides which have the potential to exacerbate the situation. How has that impacted in other trade relations as it would relate to other multilateral institutions, whether continentally or at the level of the EU and so on and so forth? It would be important to show the extent to which such options have had an impact in terms of how the South African economy has performed. If you look at it globally as well as in terms of its continental footprint, those are the issues, Chair, I would like to raise. Otherwise, I also want to say we are very much impressed with how the minister has gone to such a detail in terms of the presentation, including the DG. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Burns Namashe. Honorable Dr. Swaku.
Thank you very much, Chair. I hope that I am audible.
Yes, we can hear you.
Thank you very much. I don't have very much questions that I wanted to just to check, maybe just for clarity. I think that maybe, Chair, Minister, maybe we need to put also more money in terms of the movies that raise the consciousness of our people. Maybe movies that of the events that happened in our political space here in South Africa, because I think that we're not doing enough to fund those kind of movies. You know, our political heroes and what happened before in the country. We need to conscientize our people and understand the past that we went through, and also that past will never repeat itself, because especially for the, you know, we call them AMA 2000s. These new guys, you know, on the block. They don't understand the history of our country. So it would be very nice that we see more movies being supported, and we see them, you know, and we get the history. And some of the events we don't know, you know, It will be very nice for us as well. Some of the people who are narrating before these old, the freedom fighters, they can pass on so that we can keep that history growing. There was an investment minister and through you, Chair, that the investment, you know, the conferences that were held by the president. I wanted to check up with you. Have they those yielded any results? What are the jobs that, you know, they have created? Have the people that committed, have they came back and said, here is the money, here are the jobs, we are creating it and all of that. So have you seen any improvement on the yield on those things? I think that the one for black industrialists, that conference, minister, I just saw it on media running. I don't know if Chair were invited. It would have been nice that you go, but I saw it, but yeah, it was too late for me because I was committed. Some of the events, Minister, that you are having, and you know, department, you know, it's an internal department event. If you can maybe just get an invite, maybe we know them in time so that some of the constituencies, people are interested to go, we can just go and check them, you know, and view one of those the events you are having there. On the jobs that in totality, Minister, that, you know, the department is created through its entities and all of that, do you think that there is an impact that is that you are doing in terms of creation of the job because of the demand of the jobs that the country, you know, is facing currently? Are you feeling happy, or is there something, you know, that you could do more? We just had the industrial policy workshop, which was excellently done by the committee. We would like to thank them for that, to school us in terms of that industrial policies and different schools of thought. There were some very good some suggestions and some presentations that maybe the chair and the secretariat maybe might share to you in terms of looking at the other countries that have increased in terms, you know, the job creation through industrialization. Maybe something that maybe you can compare notes. Your researchers can compare notes with the researchers of the committee and to see that in terms of, you know, what can be done better. But are you comfortable? Are you happy? What do you think that can be done more with the jobs that you seek to create in your department then? And also, do you think that the money that we are spending, these billions, are they yielding the millions of the jobs that we really stick to achieve? Because, I mean, we do budget quite a lot to create jobs, but I don't know, some of the, you know, the actions, I mean, in terms of the performances, the performances to me, they look to me that they are more in terms of report producing and giving suggestions, but there's no tangible, massive scale job creation on the ground that you can say, with the 10 billion that I've put in, I've managed to create so much job, like your return on investment and all of that. So, but I wanted to have a wider input at some point in terms of the amount of money we're putting on job creation vis-a-vis the job that we get at the end. Because sometimes I see them with the amount of money we actually put in, we're sort of getting 400, 300 jobs there, 1,000 jobs there. You know, we're actually looking for massive, you know, that massive industrial scale job creation where we can see that a lot of people, through the efforts of the money, were able to really do, you know, to do that. I think, yeah, and on the, at, I wanted to check the industrial policy. They said, okay, I think I'm a bit clarified. They said the industrial policy were achieved on the performance. I wanted to check what industrial policies that were achieved and concretized. So I think that when Minister, also mine, an overall presentation I check is that it's just the impact in terms of, because at the end we need to create jobs, and we do spend money, and I see the number of jobs there, but now have you maybe done and said, okay, this is, we need, let's say, 4 million jobs, and then how are we going to ensure that we really do have an impact on that? And after all the information and everything, I just look at that, and I think that also on the economic research component, I think probably also there you should be looking in terms of the, maybe looking in terms of other tactics or other schools of thought that you could apply, or other ways, looking at the international, other countries like us, who have developed, you know, they were in a developmental state, how they managed to industrialize and create massive, you know, massive job, because at the end, you know, we're speaking of massive job creation. You know, where you have 10,000, 20,000 people, you know, getting done. And also, I think that there needs to be a lot of emphasis in terms of those SEZ. Because you remember SEZ, some of them are really located in the close to townships. So people, when they get these jobs and, you know, there's job creation in the SEZ, they're able to just maybe walk in there. And all of that. You look at the Newcastle, I think there are a couple of, there's an SZ or an area where there are factories, and you can see that people are walking to, I think it was Osizweni or something, you can see that there's no money spent in terms of transportation and all of that. So I think that in a nutshell, really, Minister, is to say we need to look at the job creation aggressively so, and looking at other countries that are same as us in developed state, how they've done to industrialize, but that we can actually create jobs. And also, there are some suggestions of aggressive state intervention and be in the center of really, you know, to, you know, to kickstart this economy and ensure that we create jobs. Because, I mean, after COVID, things have got very, 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 very worse. I think my last one, Chair, will be to say that with the, I'm not sure whether you are aware, but I said I was going to write to Chair. You need to look in terms of the of your entities like the IDC and NEF, in terms of how they handle the applications of the industrialists on the ground, people who are looking at that funding. It is it's actually a bit critical. There's been a really unfair treatment to some of the people that have approached us. So you need to, I think, Minister, to zoom into it and look. You know, some of the people, I think we did talk about it in the committee in terms of other people come to us. And maybe you need to have in a department a way that an independent assessor, if a person has, you know, rejected by the other department in terms of the funding, have an independent person maybe that will look in terms of those complaints, what is the problem, and sit with individuals who have spent months and a lot of money to come up with business plans and applications of this thing, and just to be told that you're fired, you know, you're not going to be funded, you are just declined. I think there must be sort of a sensitive approach, because these people, they sit in meetings and they conceptualize, they apply, but the insensitiveness that has been displayed by some within these institutions, it leaves much to be desired. I know that your Tsolo has been working on that, and also the committee with Truche, we did raise it, and they are looking into that as well. Maybe I've taken this opportunity as well to say, please, Minister, have a look at this issue, is because it might blow into your face, because people say they are receiving this assistance or financing, but you've got rotten apples there that are doing some stuff, and other allegations which are very sensitive. You know, when a person puts in terms of an idea, but individuals go behind that individual and go and talk to, you know, the person who's selling that technology or selling that idea, and maybe they want to take it on. So there is some of that thing there. It's becoming a problem on the ground. And this money must go to those who really want to, who's going to be using it on the ground. I think, Chair, those are my, you know, the contribution I will put on this. And every any other thing I will just, I see in terms of presentation, I'll just send it, you know, in terms of the writing to the minister. But those are my key things that I wanted to raise. Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Dr. Faku. I don't see any other hands. So over to you and your team, Minister, to respond to the questions and comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me start by really appreciating, I think, all the comments that have been made. There have been some questions and some suggestions. But by and large, I take it that there's been a very positive response to this way of reporting, where we lift out much more the impact and the outcome, and I do appreciate that. Chairperson, some of the comments and issues that members of Parliament have raised is food for thought that I do want an opportunity also just to reflect a little bit on the issues, particularly where they are about the balance of policy, because we've got to constantly, however certain we are about the rightness of our choices, we've got to constantly be open to better ideas, to improving our ideas, and to learning from doing. By getting out there, getting our hands dirty, we can discover what works better. So in responding to some of the issues, I'm not going to end the consideration of the suggestions and ideas. I'll get the team also just to reflect further on these issues. So first, thank you very much, Honorable Mulder. Those comments are really appreciated. And to the issues that you've raised, I mean, I think Eskom and the energy crisis is at the center of the challenge we face. We feel it in our mandate with industrialization. Many South Africans feel it in the enormous disruption to lives that's taking place. So what is it that the DTIC can do? Obviously, the one thing that we try to do is to be supportive to whatever efforts is coming from within cabinet and the responsible ministers dealing with energy-related issues. And within our scope, there are some further things we can do. The one thing is to really work hard on renewable energy to make it possible. By the nature of a report like this, we haven't covered everything we do. I would have loved to have a case study just dealing with the work that DTIC has done on getting the components of the energy value chain to have the localization requirements crafted in such a way that it does not become an obstacle, to relax the levels where needed so that we really prioritize energy generation. The second area is in funding these big renewable energy initiatives. The IDC has done the big project with Pellegrin and Aqua Power. And during the recent visit to Saudi Arabia, we had extensive discussions, further discussions with Aqua Power to hear what the experience has been in providing renewable energy in the South African market. The third thing, and there's more work being done, is in energy-saving technologies, and there's a few case studies that we highlighted, because if we are able to both increase the supply of electricity and have more energy-efficient ways of running businesses, then we can sooner get to that sweet spot where we have enough reserve that if there's any downtime at a given power station, it doesn't hurt the economy, it doesn't lead to load shedding. I think you're right about load shedding. It's been deeply damaging of our efforts on industrialization. And that's why when I sat with the team of officials, one way in which we described our work is to say that as the DTIC, we have to be so much, we'll have to work so much harder, because it's like you've got this massive wind that is pushing you off course, and you've got to push against the wind and try still to get progress in the economy. And so if we are able to get a headwind that retards us, it means we've got to put more effort in. I think there's nothing else to say on the energy thing, but to underline your point about how important it is that we get out of the load shedding. And that's why the big program that Cabinet is endorsed that is being driven now to move into fixing Eskom and into increasing renewable energy is going to be critical. On Tonga Duland, that's come up in the third quarter. I'm sure when we do the quarterly report, we'd be able to indicate the work that is being done to try to ensure that we don't have an absolute disaster in the rural areas, because Tonga Duland is not only a large company, but it's also a big aggregate and mill for many, many farmers. And so we've been watching that very carefully and trying to be as supportive as we can in the discussions. On the empowerment matter that you've raised, Honorable Mulder, I think that there's two parts to it that we need to pull out of the conversation. The one is we need to find ways in which we get more and more work to improve the growth and the jobs impact of empowerment. And so the early phases of empowerment, a lot of, we've learned a lot. Many of those elements in those programs just didn't work well. You'd see, Honorable Mulder, a much greater focus now on two things. One is worker empowerment, which really provides equity in the hands of a larger number of South Africans. And the second thing is, and by the way, when we do the worker equity, it's not done on a race basis. It's done for all workers. It happens to be that the majority of workers in a company are Black South Africans. But it also helps to create that sense of us being in this together, that South Africa belongs to all who live in it, Black and white. And so that's one element of it. The other element of it is the much sharper focus on industrialists. When you finance someone to get 10% or 20% stake in someone else's company, it's not that it's a bad thing, but it creates a different way of looking at wealth. What you're able to do is you're able to leverage and get equity in a business that's run by someone else, that was originally financed by someone else. When you're a Black industrialist and you've got to make, when we did the Black industrialist conference, and I know I'm dealing with matters that will come up in the committee, but let me just make this one example. We were looking at the car making industry, and there was Mercedes-Benz in the marketplace. We had a big Black marketplace. And when the president was walking through there, he was saying, oh, Mercedes-Benz, but what's that got to do with our Black industrialist program? And I said, Mr. President, just see what people say. And it was very dramatic when Black component manufacturers were able to take the president through it and say, and you know, the one person did it very dramatically, took his hand, and he, as the president stood there, he hit it against the bonnet of the Mercedes-Benz and then against the side fender of the Mercedes-Benz. And he said, Mr. President, this fender, this bonnet, I've made. It's been made in my factory. And it meets the highest standards globally of Mercedes-Benz, because Mercedes-Benz doesn't lower this standard for any market. They produce, because most of the Mercedes-Benz we assemble in South Africa are actually sold in Europe and other parts of the world. So we meet all the standards. And so we're bringing growth much more into it. Many white South Africans are also supported by the IDC, by the DTIC, and the fact that we don't always raise that doesn't mean that it's not happening. But because we have a deficit that proportionally a very large number of black South Africans are capable of helping to grow the economy if they get opportunity. Some will fail. We will make losses on something. Some factories will not be successful. It's the nature of any market economy that you can't guarantee success. You can try to give everybody an opportunity. Some people will fail, but they will get up and they will, in the proverbial words, dust themselves off and start again and make a success of it. And that's the nature of what we're trying to do with the Black Industrialist Program. But I do believe that merit is a very important part, that societies are driven by taking strong capability. And you will see we don't do a tick box exercise just to fill boards of entities and positions. We're trying our best within the available constraints to make sure that we get fitness for purpose, that we get strong South Africans who serve in these various public roles that there are, because merit is not something that is distributed unequally in society. Every human being has an equal chance of being strong, being capable. It's distributed not on race. You'll have really wonderful managers, wonderful doctors, technicians who are black or are white, who are Chinese, who are German. And policy is about giving people with enterprise and energy that opportunity to realize the best that they can realize. So I hope that that does help a little bit in providing some context to the empowerment issue. Honorable Tring, once again, I want to reiterate my appreciation for the comments that you've made on the report, on the and the support you're giving for the focus we're making much more now on jobs. And I do agree with you, and I'm going to also come back when dealing with Honorable Chwaku's comments around the need to get more into jobs created, because that's really the one that can reduce the levels of unemployment and give many more people an opportunity. Having said that, we must also make sure that we don't lose any of the existing jobs unnecessarily. Sometimes it's a major change in the market and it's unavoidable that a firm closes. But by and large, it's also about holding on to as much of what one can where it makes commercial sense to do so, and then growing the overall number of jobs. So you're right about that one. On the KPI dealing with the unemployment rate, because the unemployment rate is a function of so many different factors, it's hard for me to hold the DTIC officials responsible for it. For example, if the energy crisis continues, then that will have a big impact on the sustainability of businesses, which will increase the number of unemployed in society. And that's not something that the DTIC team can do an enormous amount about. They can on the edges do some work on it, but it's not an area that they've got the tools or the levers to be able to fundamentally change that. If there is floods, if there is a COVID event, if there's a war in Ukraine, all of these things impact on the overall growth rate and the overall number of jobs in the economy. If there's a collapse in the mining sector because prices of commodities come down, or if the floods wipe away our ability to use the rail line between Gauteng and KZN, and it impacts on our ability to export products, all of those affect the outcome being the unemployment rate. So what we've done instead, and I'd be really keen to get the advice and the comments from members of parliament. We've set out KPIs that are to do these reports, to do these action minutes and so on, but we've framed it within a context that says we want to see an investment outcome of 120 billion. We want to see a localization outcome of 40 billion. We want to see a manufactured exports outcome of 600 billion. Those are the things that all this activity must chase. I'll be frank with the committee, and it's one that I think the senior staff that's in the, on the platform will appreciate the comment, and they've said it as much. It's been a sea change in the culture of the department, because the department has been more traditionally used to measuring their activity, and the department has an strength in a number of activities. They're able to do, for example, a large number of export exhibitions. They do it competently, professionally. The when you go there, you see the stands. They are very well constructed. They'll have very good demographics, young people, women, all of that. That's what has been the core strength of the department up to now. Now we're changing the focus for them. I've said to them that we need to see what is the impact on actual export orders, because when you have an export order, you save a job or you create a job. And it takes time to change the culture of a very large organization and a set of organizations like the DTIC group. And if everyone's cameras were on now, you'll see broad smiles from many of the DDGs and from the DG, because they'll know what I'm talking about, that it's taken an enormous amount of time to embed a different way of looking at it, where we focus on outcomes, not on what we do, but on the impact it has on jobs and on economic inclusion and on growth. And it's a battle. It's an uneven battle where we sometimes win quite strongly. We put a lot of effort into something and we get a very small return, and we learn from that. And other times we put smart actions in and we get an enormous return. We've had a massive return in the competition space. It's really been a groundbreaking change in how things are happening as a result of the work the department and the competition authorities are doing in things like saving jobs and creating new jobs. But we haven't tooled up for it. We've inherited a public service that has got a lot of strengths, but they've not been schooled in this, so it's working with the teams and sometimes pressurizing, sometimes encouraging, sometimes accepting that we've gone as far as we can for a given month or quarter, but it's just keeping that gentle pressure to shift towards exactly where you are at, Honorable Thing, which I think is absolutely the right thing, which is we've got to look at how we make a difference to the big story. And one of the favorite things that we use in our internal meetings in DTIC is, it's become a bit of a cliche, is, are we moving the dial? Is it so small what we do that it doesn't make a change on the big scheme? So I'm sharing in the spirit of knowing that you are also deeply concerned about the same issues that we are concerned about, how we're trying to change the machinery of government to do things differently, because that machinery is not schooled to look at impact and outcome. And even just getting to the KPIs that we've got has been the result of many, many workshops that the Deputy Minister and I had with the team. And, you know, all credit to the team. In a number of cases, it's now beginning to change the way that they work. But progress is uneven, and so we won't always get all of it right, but I think we are definitely moving in the right direction compared to where we are, where we were in the past. Your point also, Honorable Tring, about dropping the growth rate of developing countries is very important because so much of our mineral resources and some of our other exports are dependent. For example, our single biggest manufacturing export is cars. If the European Union goes into recession next year, as some are projecting, then consumption of cars will come down. When consumption of cars in Europe goes down, the South African economy is hit. We sell a lot of iron ore and other minerals to China. If China's growth rate has dropped as much as it has, it's virtually half compared to what it was just a short, you know, a couple of years ago, and it's a third of what it was about 10 years ago. As that growth rate drops, the demand for South African minerals will also drop. And so you can take all of the different areas. And so we need to work through these by finding ways in which we mitigate. And it's difficult to mitigate when you don't have a massive fiscal pool of money that you can use. The United States tried to spend themselves out of the crisis they got into a year and a half ago with all these fairly generous checks that were issued by the federal government. We don't have that kind of resources in South Africa. So it's working with the cloth that we have. On the red tape issue, it is an important focus that we do need to put more energy and effort in. And I find that this is sometimes the hardest thing for public servants to get right because, again, everyone has been schooled in a particular way that in order to get things done, you need a very rigorous system. And you need rules. And when you have rules, people find ways around the rules, so you then amend the rules to block those who are trying to find a way through the rules. And then they find more ways, and then you try to block that with more rules. And in the end, your rule system, well-intentioned, just chokes off any ordinary person who tries to get anything done. And I get it. I see that. But I know also that I have to take a balanced approach when my team says, but Minister, we do need the rules because if we don't, you know, people will be able to corruptly access the resources or improperly access the resources. And it's to find that balance between it. With the ITAC matter that's come up there, it's really about making it easier for businesses to apply for trade relief. So it's a bit of an irony because when they get trade relief, those are new rules. And we want to make the rules easier to get to that point where they're able to use the rules, but also make it such that we follow due process, that we don't make it a process that's not rigorous because these are all careful balances. Do you put up tariffs on a product which will save jobs, but on the other hand, it will increase prices potentially on the domestic economy? Every day, the day job of governance is weighing that up and making a judgment call and saying that's where we're going to go. And so the processes need to be rigorous so that we don't make arbitrary decisions on a whim. On the inflationary pressure on food, a very big challenge, Honorable Tring, and you're right, your wife is absolutely right. What she's seeing is also very often coming out in the macro data. On the scrap metal and cable theft, you ask an interesting question, which is any research being done on alternative sources other than, say, copper that could enable the supply of electricity or radio signals that come from cell phones and so on. Now, of course, Telkom itself and the other companies have already moved some way down that line with fiber optic, which replaces copper. But there's a sunken cost where there's massive, you know, enormous quantities of copper cable, which can't be replaced immediately. And it's very costly. So Telkom is doing what it can to progressively deal with that and at the same time recognizing that it's got to be, you don't do a massive wiring of your system with the result that the price of mobile phone calls go massively up because you've got to recover that that capital spending. Then on the Eskom side, I understand that Eskom is already using some aluminium cables for electricity transmission. But I'm also told that there are challenges, that aluminium cable, the people who've been looking at this, they say it's more brittle and it cannot therefore easily be bent and then straightened again. You've seen it with aluminium. If you bend and straighten, you see the brittleness in it. And apparently what works better is to use aluminium where it's used. Apparently it's better for long distance transmission lines. And it's also not as efficient a conductor of electricity as copper. And so all of these things get weighed up. So without putting anything off the table, in a way there's no easy answers, and therefore we will have to deal with matters relating to cable and metal theft for the foreseeable future. Turning this to the issue around Honorable Kring that you raised, that are we allocating our quarterly targets right, given that in some quarters the target is low and it's not one quarter, so to speak, 25% of the annual target. And it was done fairly deliberately by the team, Honorable Tring, because what they find that with certain programs, it's not like this with everything, but certain programs, as you finalize your plan for the year, which would typically be done between January and March, and I would normally sign off on the plan by March. So there'll be a lot of to-ing and fro-ing January and February to say, no, shift the priorities here or focus a little bit more on that. And so there's only finality about the plan and what it will require for the year in the period March of a given calendar year. Then in April, the plan starts. So typically what the team wants then is a couple months where they tool up, they shift resources and people if needed from priorities that we may have defined a year ago to the new priorities that we put in now. And they would only know what the investment target is, for example, when we finalize the APP. And so that first 3 months, it's really tooling up and getting things going. And Honorable Tring, you'll see, I don't have the, I didn't look at the presentation now, but you'll see that each quarter, up to the fourth quarter, it tends to increase significantly. Towards the latter end of the annual performance plan, there's more than a quarter of targets in each of the last two quarters, if that makes sense. Because by then, they're on a groove. They're getting things done. They're moving things over the finish line. And typically in quarter three and quarter four, there's an enormous push to get everything completed. And then the cycle starts again. So it's not a even flow. Some things we can do in an even flow, but other things the department has found it works better to incrementally push it up. Are some of the targets artificially low? Well, the team feels that they are artificially high, some of the targets, and they've pushed back a little bit in a friendly way with me. They banter and they say, but Minister, that's too much for 1 year. And I say, but look around, you just look out in townships and in the lives of ordinary South Africans, and you can see that even setting the most ambitious target is not going to be enough. So I can explain that particular instance, Honorable Tring. Invest SA normally deals with the kind of, let's call it the big challenges where there's a water use license that is not being issued. And it would take a lot of work with different parts of the spheres of government to get that unblocked. But this year, one of the things that hit the business community very hard was a change in the way in which Home Affairs dealt with visas. Home Affairs found that there was a lot of corruption or concerns about corruption in the visa issues, so they changed the system to de-risk it. But in the process, it slowed down things very, very considerably. And so many firms had enormous problems on this matter. And so InvestSA had to literally leave, let's call it lightheartedly, their day job and really become processing centers to find out why we're not getting the CEO of this particular company's work visa sorted out. Why is the CFO in that area that is part of their continental team for the African continent allowed to come and work in the continental head office that may be in Sandton or in Joburg? And so they've had to deal with all of that because I had a flood of concerns that were expressed to me by businesses at the Japan Business Council. It came up in my meeting with the U.S. South Africa business engagement, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. It's come up from other companies. China has raised some challenges. European-based firms have raised challenges. So Yunus Hussain and his team had to literally redirect resources away from what they were traditionally doing into this area. Now there, because each visa application has got its own challenges and difficulties, it came across as a number of different unblockings, and it was for different firms and so on. So I don't expect that high number would continue. In fact, I hope it doesn't continue because it will show that the system, we haven't been able to make the system reforms. And I know Minister Motsoaledi is really working hard on it and is very committed to making those system reforms that makes it unnecessary for us to get in on each of those work permit issues. Honourable Cuthbert, thank you for your comment and on the specific questions that you've raised, Honourable Cuthbert. In fact, Honourable Cuthbert, you've been reading my notes. You've been reading my notes because as late as yesterday, I had a meeting with the DTIC officials to say that we needed to do more work on the broader impact of localization, just pulling together the different streams. You'll see in this presentation, there were many different projects that are localization projects. And I say localization is one that I think you will also support, Honorable Cuthbert, because it's really about increasing the output of the South African economy. That's what it is. And I'll come back to an aspect of it when I deal with Honorable Swaku's question about jobs. But what we wanted to do is we also want to do the monetary value of localization. And so I hope by quarter three, definitely by quarter four, that we would have a very significantly more detailed report.
It isn't acting like a fucking product that's employed by member states to do a specific job. What I'm fucking doing.
Kruger, please mute.
Thank you, Chairperson. And so the idea would be to put a lot of time and effort into it, and I think the results are going to be quite positive if you all want to know where my thinking is about it. But let's have a look at it, and we're definitely going to try to find a monetary metric because that's the target we've set ourselves. But we've got to do it in a way that it is a rigorous calculation, that it doesn't count things that were done in the past, that it's not just repurposing, that we want to bring some rigor to it. On the question of localization and inflation, it can cut both ways, Honorable Cuthbert. You'd be familiar with the, let's call it the more neoclassical concern about localization and its impact on pricing. But there's another part to it. Countries that have very little agricultural production have seen a much bigger spike in their food basket than South Africa has had to date. And I say it guardedly because we don't know what the future holds, and the Competition Commission is actively monitoring food prices, and we're taking such steps as we reasonably can take to deal with these issues. But when you have when you become very subject to imports, then whatever happens on global markets immediately impact on you. And when there's shortages, for example, during COVID-19, we needed a very large number of medical grade face masks, not these white and blue ones that you and I wear, but the ones that doctors wear in ICU and in COVID wards and so on. And we couldn't find sufficient stocks of it. I know the Solidarity Fund did its best to try to get masks from all over the world and so on. But because we had some local industrial capability, we could work with local companies to repurpose that and produce those masks. We did the same with the ventilators. And because we had, when the Aspen plant in Kabega was built, it wasn't built as a COVID vaccine plant because there was no COVID at the time when the company put in the application to the DTIC for effectively a partnership around that, where they committed enormous sums of capital that they could then have some of that written off over a period. We had in mind that it would be a sterile facility, but not that it would be one that's capable of producing vaccines for a pandemic. But the fact that we had that enabled us to be able to bring it into production fairly quickly. So there's a significant consensus emerging globally now that while in the past everybody just looked at competitiveness, now more and more businesses and government looking at resilience, how to make sure that our economy is capable to take knocks. And so we've got to keep an eye, because anything taken too far can have negative effects, but we do need to do what we can to build the South African economy, to create industrial capacity here and to create jobs here. On the appointment processes of the BG, we're working on it now, and the Interministerial Committee is seized with the matter, and I hope that it could move fairly rapidly on this issue, because that would help enormously for longer term planning. So we're moving as fast as we can, and hopefully if I have the ability to give a specific date in future, then I will come back and provide that. Similarly, on ITAC, we've now had interviews that were conducted. A shortlist has been developed, and we're looking at the next steps that need to be taken on ITAC. On scrap metal, when will the decision be taken? I'm hoping, Honorable Cuthbert, and I said maybe a little bit lightheartedly, that you're looking forward with anticipation, with positive anticipation to the outcome. And I would hope that you'd also like the outcome. We've done an enormous amount of work. We've taken it through processes. We've got legal comment. We've comment from economists and others. We're now just doing one last leg, which is to get a final set of comments from the security cluster. And thereafter, we'll take it to cabinet. So because it's in areas of the state that we're consulting with different people, we've got to make sure that we get it done thoroughly. But I'm hopeful that we can get a decision very soon. And I then look forward to the press release where Honorable Cuthbert praises government for the measures to address this cable and metal theft. On AGOA, we will be having further discussions on AGOA in December with the US administration, and then we will also be inviting trade ministers and the U.S. administration to come to South Africa in 2023 on the matter. We've now met with African trade ministers, and the unanimous view on the African continent is that we should all be seeking for an extension of AGOA. I met yesterday afternoon with the newly appointed trade minister of Kenya. He flew in to meet with me. It was his second day in the job, he proudly said to me, and he had already flown to South Africa, and we further discussed the AGOA matter. So our own view is that the optimal solution or the optimal policy choice for the longer term for the United States and Africa in the partnership that the U.S. envisages would be to extend AGOA. Obviously, these matters are subject to a lot more engagement and discussion. Honorable Burns, Namashi, thank you for the really warm comments and the points that you've made on the appointment of entities. I appreciate, because it's about making sure we take the time. There are many talented people, but it's taking the time. They don't always apply. They don't always put their name up for a board when there's a public advert. So it's about making sure that we don't just settle for ticking the box, but that we do a degree of thorough work so that we really rebuild the state and we get state capability back, because the state has lost a lot of capability, and we do nobody any service by denying it. We've got to confront it, deal with it, and do what we can to improve capability in our entities. On foreign policy, I think generally what we do is we communicate with everybody. We reach out to everybody. South Africa's probably been visited by a range of people with many different interests globally in terms of heads of state. We recently had the president of the Spanish government, otherwise known as the prime minister, spending time here with President Ramaphosa, talking through a number of issues, and that will come up in our quarter three report, so I'm not going to go further on that one. And essentially what all of that is about is South Africa does put forward a view that we think is consistent with the role we've always played, that we don't try to pick fights with others. We try to see that a world that is at peace with itself is a world in which human development can better be achieved, that poverty can be tackled, that unemployment can be tackled, that the world is generally better off if all the considerable resources of humanity is trained on fighting the war on poverty, if I can put it that way. But in all of these things, we do want to talk to all sides and deal with issues in that mature way. Honorable Swaku, thank you for the comments that you've made. Some very warm comments, including your support for the way in which we're dealing with the movies. One of the issues that in the discussion with the president, that the president has been very passionate about, and it's an area that I believe is really important, is that South Africans have to tell their stories. And it's not just one story, it's many stories that make up our nation. And part of that story is also the story about our bitter past, and telling it in a way that both inspires hope, that brings South Africans together in the end, but that doesn't brush difficult things under the carpet, because our history has been a difficult history, and we need to confront it. So movies is a part of a world, a society, a community telling their stories. And the story we've had up to now, there's been a dominant global story, and the stories of the South, the stories of Africans, have not been told. And that's why we don't only support the telling of the South African stories, but also of African stories, of a continent that needs to feel more confident about itself and its own way of dealing with history and the future. So we want to do more in this space, but sometimes it's also telling the very human stories And it's not the stories of our past is, and of our present is not only stories of black South Africans, it's also stories of white South Africans. It's some moving stories, really at the human level, very, very moving stories about all parts of South Africa. And we're telling that, and I hope we're telling it with a lot more confidence. And I say we, I mean young filmmakers that are coming in, and many of them are supported by the work that we do. On the investment conferences and are they yielding any results? What I've tried to do, Honorable Swaku, in this presentation is we haven't done it systematically, but in many slides you'll see we point to the fact that that announcement was made at a investment conference, say 4 years ago, 2 years ago. Now we see the jobs, we see the investment and so on. So in fact, if you have an opportunity just to perhaps look at some of those, they will draw that line very well. And so without any question, the investment does have a positive effect. And point is taken that there are more things that we can do. But Honorable Tsok, you ask a really important question, which is, can we do more? And the answer has to be that we must do more. It's not can we. There isn't a choice we have that when young people are without hope, then a department like the DTIC and the DTIC group has to find the inner strength to be able to do more all the time. And it's hard. It's hard on some of the officials. There are some really hardworking officials who it's not uncommon for them to have meetings with me at late at night, early morning and so on. So I rely on them to do this. And I think there's no question we've got to do more. Now, where? How? So obviously, if we had a bigger budget, we can do more. We've got a relatively modest budget compared to the scale of the challenges we're facing. And then in addition to that, even if we had more money, it's not all of the problems can't be solved with money. Many of the problems require other innovative ways. And it's also trying to get the state to partner differently with the private sector to be able to unlock many more jobs. Sometimes just removing unnecessary red tape or just putting in a real obligation on a company that gets public resources that they need to do more to grow jobs is often even more helpful than making financial incentives available. On the is the money yielding much? Well, I think it does yield a lot, but I have no doubt we can do even more. Not all of our programs are necessarily 100% efficient. And we mustn't be defensive about it. You can't run any big program and say you've done it perfectly. There will always be scope to improve. And on the issue around an aggressive job creation scheme, other than public works programs, the only other big things that a state can do is to strongly invest in infrastructure, in energy, in transport logistics, in water, but also an ICT, but also in skills for young people. We are putting an enormous amount of money that we're investing into higher education with the fee-free system. And our hope is that we will find a big economic return as that generation of young people who would otherwise not have been able to afford university begins to enter the labor market. As entrepreneurs, as job creators, not just as people who will be looking for work, but also people who will be making work that they can bring other young people in. The other bit is localization. And I know that sometimes in the media, commentators get a little bit bored and they work themselves up on issues of localization. But the more I travel the world, the more I realize it. So many countries have localization programs. When we're in Saudi Arabia now, they've got a major Made in Saudi program that that they run. Where in the United States, last year when I had a, was it last year? Yes, it was last year. in one of our strong engagements with the U.S. administration, talk turned to the Buy America campaign and what they're doing as government using public resources to rebuild the American manufacturing capabilities. And so it's happening all over the world. It's not something that's only happening in China. I sat with my Indian counterpart looking at their Made in India program. So everywhere people are finding ways in which to create jobs or support the activities that can help to create jobs for young people through localization. And we've got a lot of scope to do it. But we've got to have the courage to persevere, to do the right things. Where something doesn't make sense, we must move on, leave it, and rather work on the things that make sense. But localization is a big thing. And then finally, the African Continental Free Trade Area. That, as we unlock that, it will also have an enormous opportunity to create jobs. On the entities that you've raised and how they handle applications, I've taken note of the comment. And Honorable Swaki, you said that we must watch out that there may be rotten apples, as you call it, people going behind promoter of an idea. Wherever that happens, I really would welcome and encourage honorable members, when you hear about any of this, please do let us know. We've got to be absolutely vigilant all the time against corruption. It's not a beast that when you slay it once, then it's dead. It has many lives and many heads, and you can chop off its head and it will grow another two heads. So you've got to be constantly battling against any possibility of corruption. And that's why if the Honorable Member has any information, I would really like to receive it so that we can investigate it and deal with it. We are looking at an independent assessor, whether it is in an advisory thing like a ombud, whether it is in a decision-making thing like a panel that decides what can be done, because we've had complaints, a number of complaints from clients of our development finance institutions, from the department itself. If I could save all the time that I got complaints in how the DTIC administers its film incentive, for example, I would have had maybe another couple of days in my life that I would have been able to use productively on other matters for the DTIC. So we've got to try to deal with it. We've had complaints from clients of the IDC that have asked us to review these things. The difficulty we've had to figure out is not every application is a good application. Not every application will succeed. It's the nature of it. There are 60 million South Africans. There'll be a tiny number that can be supported by the DFIs. They need to have systems. I've got to give their boards the freedom to set up the systems, the guidelines, and so on. When ministers get to the point of getting into the level of detail to say, well, you know, you should give a grant or a loan to this company rather than that company, we would have made the biggest mistake. That is not only the road to corruption, but it's also the road to enormous misallocation of resources, because no minister will have the time, energy, skill, capacity to be able to go through that. So we create systems that must work. And that means boards for the two development finance institutions that are principally responsible for this. They must then recommend strong and capable people that are able to deal with the applications. And I've got to give a degree of latitude. In other words, if every decision, every statement, everything that a CEO or board makes is challenged, it is a signal of loss of confidence. And one needs to be cautious not to overdo that. At the same time, we are pushing back where we see that there is inefficiencies in any of the development finance institutions, and I've been very, very clear about those. But at the same time, to do it such that even though you're pressurizing them, we don't end up with the ministry having to make those decisions. So what about putting an independent assessor in? The challenge is, if every applicant goes to that assessor, we'll have to build a massive machinery to review every decision that every public official takes. And so for every official that we have will do the work, we will have to probably have another official to evaluate a complaint about whether they've done their work properly. So I've got to find the balance. I've got to make sure that the system that we put in place doesn't result in frivolous or vexatious complaints that can tie up the resources of the department, because our limited budget has to stretch into the areas that's important to South Africans. That's jobs, it's economic growth, it's inclusion of women and rural communities and young people, and so it's balancing that carefully. So I have asked the DG to look at this, and he has said to me that there's been quite a bit of thinking about it. I am clear that we need a reform of the system. We do need to have some way in which we can check without it having to come to a minister whether a complaint someone has raised is valid under the circumstances, and particularly whether any public servant is abusing their position by vexatiously refusing, by penalizing people because they've complained. All of those concerns I hear regularly, and we do need to deal with it. So I think you've put the spotlight, Honorable Swaku, on an area that I think is a challenge in our institutional machinery and that we must deal with. So I hope, Chairperson, that I have answered at least most of the questions. And as I said at the start, a lot of it is food for thought, and it's an ongoing conversation between members of the legislature and members of the executive on a number of these issues, particularly policy choices, and I do appreciate hearing it. And I think today's session really was different to many of the others in that I think the team feels affirmed that the work that they've done is helpful to members of parliament, that members of parliament find this format, this way of focusing on the work, to be more helpful to delivering to South Africa's people. So thank you very much for this opportunity, Chairperson, and to the DG and the team also for the work that they've done, and the two deputy ministers for the guidance and the oversight that they provide. May I then hand back to you, Chairperson?
Thank you very much, Minister, and the team for the, I think, very thought-provoking and presentation, which also answers the challenge set to us by the AG in looking more at the impact of our spend on South Africa. So thank you very much for that enlightening presentation. We have gone way over time, and I see I'm running out of battery, and I want to thank everyone for being part of this meeting, and then just hand over to the committee secretary to speak to us about our program going forward. Thank you very much, committee secretary.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, we scheduled to tomorrow to look at, to get a briefing from the NRCS as well as SABS on the annual report, as well as the first quarter financial and non-financial performance reports, Chair. Also, we will also give the opportunity to the AG's office to give a short input on some issues relating to SABS for clarification, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone, for being part of this meeting. Have a good day further.
Thank you to our Chairperson.
Recording stopped.